ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
It's Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez. And though we may be in the middle of March, because I am a poor planner, we're actually starting a new centennial tribute this month as we honor actor Robert Preston. Guest Kimberly Pierce is going to join me throughout the next two episodes to discuss Preston's impact and film career. We start with his 1939 film debut-ish in the movie Union Pacific. Born as Robert Meservey in Newton, Massachusetts, the man we know as Robert Preston had a relatively uninspiring childhood. After graduating from high school, Meservey studied acting at the Pasadena Community Playhouse and soon obtained a studio contract from Paramount Pictures. He received his first screen credit in 1938 in the film King of Alcatraz. The movie isn't just known as the debut of Robert Meservey, the person. It's also the debut of the man known as Robert Preston, the actor, as he took Paramount's suggestion to drop his last name in favor of using his middle name, which soon caught on, and now we know him as Robert Preston. He soon caught the eye of legendary director Cecil B. DeMille, who cast him in his Ode to the Railroad, 1939's Union Pacific. Up until 39, the Western was a hollow shell of its former self, populated by cheap dime-a-dozen productions, and it was certainly living up to its name as the Oders. DeMille himself was riding high from the success of his 1938 feature, The Buccaneer, and was unsure whether he wanted to make a movie about planes, trains, or boats. Either way, whatever one, it was going to be about transportation. After his initial idea fell through, DeMille decided on the railroad. But what railroad would his film be about? The Union Pacific or the Santa Fe? Well, a simple flip of the coin ended up settling the debate, and we know what won. Like many of DeMille's features, he spared no expense, getting the help of the actual Union Pacific to supply research, records, even actual trains. Because of how often he was working with them, DeMille would eventually have to get a license from the Interstate Commerce Commission, becoming the largest private owner of a railroad in the U.S.
Oh, don't start out by making me hate you.
You won't hate me, Molly. You'll love me.
Spectacle. Turbulent, triumphant. Spectacle that surges across the 3,000-mile canvas of a continent. Adventure. The heroic men and women whose blood, sinews, and backbone dare the impossible.
Considering this is a DeMille film, it's no surprise that the shoot had difficulties. DeMille ended up directing from a stretcher after undergoing a surgery prior to production. The film more than earned its million-dollar budget, recreating Cheyenne, Wyoming, and Utah, and having a lavish three-day premiere party on, you guessed it, a train. The Western came back in a big way during the golden year of 1939. Dodge City and Destry Rides Again were also released the same year as Union Pacific, but it's often assumed that this was overshadowed by a movie that came out just 2 months beforehand, John Ford's legendary Stagecoach. Instead of DeMille bringing back the Western in a way similar to how he'd set the stage for the epic, it was actually Ford's film that is cited as the movie that turned Westerns from stodgy cheapies back into A-list Best Picture material. Though Union Pacific was the highest-grossing Western that year, it was only nominated for one Oscar in visual effects, which it lost. Then again, who could compete with anything in 1939, considering how many amazing movies came out? As for Robert Preston, he ended up having a long, long career, but the role that made him immortal was still a few years away. When we come back, Kimberly Pierce and I dive deep into Union Pacific. It's a new month, listeners, and a new star for our centennial celebration theme this year. We are talking about the acclaimed character act, partial song and dance man for a time. We're talking about Robert Preston throughout the month of March, and we are starting things off with a look at his first major film, which is 1939's Union Pacific. Probably one of the more bizarre choices that you will find on this podcast, because we tend to pick things that seem very me, or at least things that I know I would pick. A Cecil B. DeMille movie about trains and the Old West is not exactly something that I would have picked. But I didn't want us to have another devotion like Snafu, where I picked a movie sight unseen that I knew after I saw it was not going to be any good. I mean, the episode was good. The movie was, I think Lauren was a bit higher on it than I was. But I went with a movie that I had seen that I knew would foster some discussion. Long story short, we're talking Union Pacific, and this month I am joined by fellow citizen dame Kimberly Pierce. She will be here this month to talk about all things Robert Preston. Kim, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm great. Well, thank you for coming back. You were last here in October when we talked about House on Haunted Hill. And because you'll be here all month and you've been here before, I'll give you a chance to promote and all of that at the end of the episode so we can dive right into 1939's Union Pacific. This is, again, made during the golden year, essentially, where all those other movies that you know and love, including some films like a little film called The Wizard of Oz, Gone with the Wind, came out the same year. We'll get to all of those in a second. But this stars Barbara Stanwyck, Joel McCrae, and Robert Preston. It's based on a novel called Troubleshooter by Ernest Haycox, who is a famed Western author. Plot, in a nutshell, it's 1862. The Pacific Railroad Act, which has been signed by Lincoln, authorizes moving the Union Pacific Railroad west across the wilderness towards California. And there are people who don't want it to go any further. So they hire Jeff Butler, played by Joel McCrae, who is a troubleshooter who is trying to fight the people that are trying to stop the railroad. He also has a best friend named Dick, played by Robert Preston, who is in league with the bad guys, but he's also really kind-hearted. And Dick is in love with Molly Monaghan, an Irish Spitfire played by Barbara Stanwyck. And we're going to talk about Barbara Stanwyck in a second because I have so many thoughts on her character. And Molly finds herself being drawn to Jeff, the Joel McCrae character. So they have a bit of a love triangle on what is essentially a railroad Western story. I had never seen this movie before.
Neither had I.
So we are both first-timers. We had originally talked about doing the Macomber Affair. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, that is a little too hard to find. Even this was hard to find on short notice. But we could not find a copy of The Macomber Affair. I ended up finding a copy of The Macomber Affair, and I ended up watching it. It's very good. It's about on par, I think, if we had put it on here, if we had talked about it. I finally got to see it, though. It's a very interesting interpretation of Hemingway's novel. And then we had originally talked about doing... We're going to talk about Bogest.
Yes.
We were going to talk about that with Gary Cooper. And then I watched it, and I realized that Robert Preston was barely in it.
Which I had completely forgotten.
Yeah, it's really a Gary Cooper movie. He's hardly in the film. So I did not want, again, another devotion snafu. So I decided to go back to a film that I had seen before, which was this. This is the first film Robert Preston movie I watched for my Robert Preston rewatch. I had never seen this. I had heard about it, but Westerns are not my genre. And that seems to be all I'm watching as I'm watching Robert Preston's filmography so far. I like this. We associate DeMille with epics, three-hour opuses, religious films. And I think people tend to forget that DeMille did not strictly play in that sandbox. Union Pacific is a really good example of what he could do when he was reined in somewhat. This is still over a two-hour movie.
Well, that's where I struggled a bit because it felt like he wanted to go into his epic. There were so many little angles and so many little dueling plot points. That was a 2-hour and 10-minute movie, and I don't think it necessarily needed to be.
Well, Kim, what was your background with this movie before we talked about it, and what'd you think of it?
It was completely new to me, actually. I am admittedly weak, especially with Joel McCrae. I am pitifully underviewed in Barbara Stanwyck, something I'm quickly trying to remedy. So I had never heard of this one before. I have dotted my way through some of Preston's early filmography, but I'm actually much better with his later stuff. So I was interested to jump into this and interested to kind of see what was going on. And it was essentially what I expected, a bit more complicated, but then thinking about it, it was DeMille. I enjoyed it. I've seen it twice now since we've started discussing it. I'd watch it again.
I was very surprised by how engaging this movie is. I do think you brought up some of the things it suffers from. We can get more in depth in that. You can see DeMille trying to give us the whiz bang that he had been known for. My DeMille history. I think I've seen The Sign of the Cross. That's about it. I think that's the only DeMille epic I've seen. The Sign of the Cross is probably DeMille at his funnest. Fun being an operative
See, and
word.
I have never seen that. I've got my Ten Commandments knowledge beyond that.
See, I can't do that. I can't do that. That's way too long. Ben-Hur nearly killed me, okay? Sign of the Cross I recommend because A, there's lions eating people, and Frederick March is wearing like a little tiny gladiator skirt, and Claudette Colbert take a milk bath. There's gifs out there, but there's nudity in it. Definitely worth watching. Just being like, how did this movie
Sign
get
of the Cross,
made?
so we're talking young Frederick March. I could get into that.
Yes, everybody is very young. Everybody is very young and supple because, of course, they were bathing in milk, probably.
True,
So
that would do it.
let's talk about the man of the hour, though, Mr. Robert Preston. What is your background with him as an actor before?
Before watching this, I mean, The Music Man is probably in my top fives. I've been watching that since elementary school was when I was first introduced to that. And that was actually probably because I really liked Shirley Jones growing up. So, Oklahoma, and I'm ashamed to admit it, the Partridge Family. And was kind of drawn over to finally check that one out. Getting into it, I watched BoJess during a Donald O'Connor film rewatch that I did when I was probably in high school during a baby Donald
That's
O'Connor. And
right,
that
he's
was, so
little
that was my
BoJess.
first kind of introduction to that. Victor Victoria are kind of the ones that come up to mind as some of my favorites. So I have definitely jumped into his later part of his career quicker. I've known the gist of kind of what went on during his earlier career, but it's something I would love to sink my teeth into more at some point.
My history with Robert Preston is I had seen his later stuff, his stuff with Blake Edwards. Victor Victoria is fantastic. He's great in it. SOB, he's also really great. The SOB is just a great movie. If you've not seen it, you should watch it. Bill Holden and Julie Andrews, that also has nudity in it. Wow. It's really good. A very bleak satire of Hollywood. I figured Robert Preston's career was much like what I was seeing. The funny side guy who had some hidden depths to him. And going back in time and starting where I have, I'm realizing that was so not the case. He really came into his own as the 60s to the 70s and the 80s would happen. Much of his early stuff is him reprising this role. He is playing Dick Allen in every movie I've seen. So I am up to about 1948 in his career after he came back from the war. And I'm just like writing the same things down in my notes. He always tended to play the second banana, the boyfriend or husband or spurned lover that is fighting with the lead for the girl or over the girl or because of the girl, and usually ends up dying, either in some sort of bizarre redemption for his soul. His characters were always bad guys, but they were bad guys that were good. They
Yes.
came from this place of whether it was the need for financial stability or because they were following orders. He wasn't a villain. He was just misguided.
And essentially, to draw a comparison, kind of that I was thinking of, it's a less refined Harold Hill that doesn't sing and dance.
So I'm excited to talk to Music Man because I've never seen it. So I'm very interested to see
Yeah.
where it fits into his oeuvre. This movie follows so many of the Robert Preston-y roles that I've watched. He did a Veronica Lake movie. He did This Gun for Hire, which is a movie that I've seen several times. He's that guy who, I'm trying to think of who the quote is from. I want to say it's Kirsten Dunst in Elizabethtown. He's impossible to forget, but hard to remember.
Orlando Bloom.
It's Orlando Bloom. Thank you. It's
Yeah.
Elizabethtown. I knew that. So I never remember that he's in these movies. But once I know he's there, I'm like, oh, okay, well, Robert Preston's really good. So you watch him in Union Pacific, and he's no different than his character in something like Northwest Mounted Police from 1940, where he's in love with Paulette Goddard, who was in
Right.
some horrible brown face, or something like Reap the Wild Wind, where he's in love with Susan Hayward, and then she dies because he's an idiot. The Macomber Affair, he gets bested by Gregory Peck, because who wouldn't? It's the same type of character, and that had to get really boring. But here,
What cracks me up, and I'm going to get probably hate mail for this. He's always the second banana to your Joel McCrays, your Gary Coopers, your Gregory Pecks. I mean, I like Gregory Peck, I like Gary Cooper, but they've never been near the top of my list. I have a very love-hate relationship with Gary Cooper. I actually find him boring in some roles.
You're not wrong. Maybe I haven't watched the right ones, but I can't recall a Gary Cooper movie that I've liked him in. I've liked movies that he's been in, but I never necessarily like him.
I find Preston, I mean, even when he's stuck in this typecasting, he's so magnetic. He's so charming. He's so charismatic. To partner up him up against some of these, I hate to say, these bland male leads, it feels like such a waste.
Obviously, it feels fresh because it's his first serious outing. This was not Robert Preston's first film. Cecil B. DeMille tried to lay claim to Robert Preston, said he discovered him. And Robert Preston made a couple more movies with him after this, stuff like Reap the Wild Wind, and he didn't really like him. He didn't enjoy working with him. He did not enjoy working with him on this. This was really his fourth film, but the movie that I think gave him his career.
Right.
And it's really, really enjoyable to watch him in this because he's cultivating this smooth-talking, quasi-con man type of persona. But at the same time, it's not threatening. It's not malicious. It's just selfish. His motives are purely for his own selfish interests. But you can't really blame him. You can't really hate him for that.
No, he's not villainous by any stretch, but selfish is probably the best way to put it. He's in it for himself.
The introduction of Joel McCrae comes in. Really, Joel McCrae and Robert Preston seem more evenly matched in this movie than some of Preston's later films. Gary Cooper and Gregory Peck are, I mean, they're going to win. You know that. At least Joel McCrae seems passable. And Robert Preston has his little Clark Gable mustache, and it seems like he's got something going for him.
That wavy 1930s hair.
Yes. Can we talk about how this is set in 1862? And he is the poster child for Brill Cream.
That was 1930s matinee idol right there.
Yes. Oh my gosh. And he's smooth with Barbara Stanwyck. I mean, the entire movie is him saying, like, hey girl, we should get married and we should spend our lives together. And she's like, no, because I'm Irish and I'm not doing a bad accent. That's how she talks in this movie. I enjoy him in this. It's just the problem is it hobbled him for a long time because even when he did play the lead in a movie, I think of something like, if anybody has the chance to find it, YouTube. 1941's Lady from Cheyenne with Loretta Young, where he does play the male lead. And he is such a smooth-talking 1800s male chauvinist pig. But the movie is so feminist and progressive that you're, like, swayed by it. It is the weirdest movie ever. You should go watch it. It's on YouTube.
Adding that to my list.
Yeah. And that's what he works in. He works well towing that line of, I'm the comedic relief, I'm the second banana, I know I'm not gonna win the girl, but I'm gonna have a hell of a fun time doing it.
That sums it up perfectly.
Let's talk about the character a little bit more. What did you think about his relationship with Joel McCrae? We talk on my podcast a lot about homoeroticism. Him and Joel McCrae, you're talking about how they're partners and how they've spent all this time together, and their relationship is pretty close.
Isn't there a line in there where they talk about living under blankets and living under tents?
Yes! I'm so glad you saw it. I saw this a week ago, so it's not nearly as fresh as I wanted it to be. But yes, I was hoping you remembered. I knew there was a scene where they're talking about that.
You can really pinpoint it because they're what? Old army buddies. And so they're playing up in that late 1930s way. They've been out in the wilderness, out on their own, you know, fighting the battles, fighting the good fight together. So they've built up this strong bond, which, insert whatever they wanted to do, the meaning like that, but then the girl comes in the way. So we have this love triangle with Stanwyck kind of inserted in there, but in a sense, the girl gets in the way of their relationship too.
I am all for 1940s romance between two bros. It happens more often in these movies than you think. I mean, if you're not looking for it, then you won't really notice it. If you are looking for it, then you will notice it. But it's kind of undeniable here.
That code came in and they had to find other ways to say what they wanted to say.
Right. And Preston has these movies where he's opposite very dominant, manly men.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that I always found intriguing, and if we had talked about the Macomber affair, I think it would have come up, is that Robert Preston's characters are situated as the wrong type of masculine. Whether they're physically weak, like in the Macomber affair, or they're just selfish. A real man, McCrae's character,
right,
is a man who is fighting for something more than himself.
Gary Cooper's the exact same thing. He is that all-American, yeah, white bread, white milk masculinity.
I had to take a bit of umbrage with Jeff Butler as a character, because Dick's wooing of Molly, it's very romantic. It does come from a place of love, at least that I saw.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she has a job. He's not telling her that she needs to quit her job.
Yeah.
He's offering her companionship and something that really loves her. And he's willing to take a bullet for her if he has to. Really, his only flaw is that, oh, he's working for the bad guys.
Looking at the McCrae character's relationship with Stanwyck's character and then Preston with Stanwyck, I bought Stanwyck and Preston more. She's into McCrae's, yeah, character, and she ends up with Preston because he's there. But I believed her and Preston's chemistry a lot more than I did her and McCrae.
At a certain point in the movie, Stanwyck marries Robert Preston's character to protect him.
Right.
And so there's a lot of moral ambiguity here, because the movie wants to situate Jeff Butler as this picture-perfect idea of a man. But at the same time, Molly knows that Robert Preston is not a bad guy, necessarily.
Right.
And she's still willing to marry him. And I wanted those two crazy kids to get together.
Exactly.
Let's talk about Barbara Stanwyck briefly. We talked about our fair share of Barbara Stanwyck movies on this podcast. Most recently, we talked about Christmas in Connecticut, where we talked about Barbara Stanwyck being thirsty. She's always been the woman who has never shied away from saying that, you know, she wants a guy.
Mm-hmm.
In this movie, it's a bit less overt. I mean, she's not really necessarily hiding that she's into Joel McCrae, I would say, but she's not jumping on him.
Yeah.
By this point, Barbara Stanwyck had been established. She had made several movies. This was coming 2 years after her tour de force performance in Stella Dallas.
Yeah.
After this, she would do Golden Boy and Remember the Night. She did Golden Boy the same year as this. As Molly Monahan, we gotta talk about the accent, or the lack of accent.
The wavering accent.
Her depiction of an Irish brogue is just to turn up the ends of her sentences. So she'll be talking, and she'll be like, oh, I'm Molly Monahan. And you're like, oh God, why'd you go up in the line? That's Irish for her.
I didn't know that was a question.
Yeah, exactly. And that's it. That's perfect. That is how she talks Irish. Occasionally she'll get a bit of a run and she'll really like ramp it up, but it's Barbara Stanwyck sounding like Barbara Stanwyck. What did we think of her in this movie?
There are points where I'm like, okay, I could believe this accent. And then there are points where it just felt like it wasn't even trying. I hate to draw the completely unrelated comparison. Aidan Gillen's character in Game of Thrones, it was changing, it was evolving, it was going away, it was coming back. And I'm like, oh, how cute. Look at her trying that.
I'm not a big fan of her performance in this, mostly because I've seen Stanwyck in so many better movies.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you don't get much better than Stella Dallas right before this.
And for her to play Stella Dallas, where she's the lead of that film, I mean, she anchors that performance. And in even other movies like The Mad Miss Manton, which she had made right before this, it's going to come down to she's good, but I don't necessarily think this is a role that benefits from having Barbara Stanwyck specifically.
Oh, I was trying to look at, interpret for those moments where it's like, where is Stanwyck trying to make this more interesting? I was desperately trying to find why they would use an actress like her in this role, because she is so dominant, so amazing. Just, she brings so much to each of her roles. And this can be a flat character. And this could have been really bad in the hands of a different actress.
I'm not saying that any pretty young thing on the studio lot could have played this
role,
but I don't know if you really need Barbara Stanwyck to play this role. She's got great moments with Robert Preston, and you think for a minute that she's sticking with him. He's not mean to her. She really has no reason other than the fact that she doesn't love him, to really run away with him. But you know, as soon as she says to Jeff, she's made this commitment, she's gonna stay, that you're like, okay, well, something's gonna happen because they have to end up together. Molly and Jeff have to end up together. And when Dick says that he's gonna meet her in Ogden in Utah, you're like, oh God, something's gonna happen. And we'll talk about his demise at the end, because I think that that's really interesting. I was gonna say funny, but we'll say interesting for now. We've talked about Barbara Stan, we've talked about Robert Preston. Let's talk about Joel McRae, otherwise known as my mom's sexiest golden age guy. So,
he's adorable. The only other movie of his after this I've really seen that I've had a memory of was Foreign Correspondent.
So you haven't seen him in, like, Sullivan's Travels?
I've never seen Sullivan's Travels, no.
So good. It's the movie that made me love Veronica Lake. Definitely excellent. Watch it. I've seen McRae outside of the Westerns. I like him more as romantic leading man, more than anything. So the aforementioned Sullivan's Travels, The More the Merrier, Palm Beach Story, I think is also him. All three of those movies have some sexy, sexy moments in them. This does not. Joel McRae's solid. He's solid.
I would say, what, a B-plus player for a long time.
And we have a great group of character actors. Brian Donlevy's in here. He plays the always looks like he's sweaty villain. I don't know. Was I the only one that thought that Brian Donlevy was just perpetually sweaty? The end scene where he's just like waiting in the shadows for Joel McRae. I'm like, dude, I'm starting to think you might have consumption
those lights must have been so hot.
Anthony Quinn is one of those characters. I was very surprised he wasn't playing a Mexican stereotype in this movie.
Yeah.
But he gets the scene where you're starting to think that maybe Molly's cursed because this guy shows up and he's talking about getting a letter from his wife. And then he goes to the bar and there's an altercation with Anthony Quinn's character, Cordray, and the guy ends up dying. And Barbara Stanwyck has a really great moment. She goes up to the guy. The guy says, oh, can you read my letter that I got from my wife? And it's an advertisement for something. And she has to make up this beautiful, moving letter that this guy is going to hear in his death throes.
That was beautifully done.
It's a beautifully done scene, but at the same time, Anthony Quinn is dispatched fairly quickly after that.
Speaking of character actors, what surprised the heck out of me and that I enjoyed was, and I'm going to butcher the name, Akim Tamaroff as Fiesta. Insert the Mexican stereotype there.
He's good. I did find him a little grating.
That surprised the heck out of me.
Oh, okay.
My knowledge of him is Ocean's 11. So it was like, oh, him!
Hey, I found him to be a taste annoying, talking about his wives and everything, but I expected him. I mean, I was like, okay, it's a DeMille movie. I should expect one thing that doesn't age properly. DeMille had started his career, I mean, he paved the way for these movies with The Plainsman. In 1939, you got a lot of odors. I'm looking at TCM's article that they did on this. This came out the same year as Stagecoach and Destry Rides Again and what I brought up, Dodge City. And all three of those movies, I would say Dodge City probably, I haven't seen Destry. Stagecoach doesn't quite go with what I was going to say, but Dodge City at least and this are looking at the concept of like manifest destiny. With our blood, sweat, tears, and our lives, created this concept of westward expansion in a way that doesn't feel completely authentic to history because it takes out obviously the unpleasant things like oppression and Native Americans. Actually, no, the Native Americans are in here and they're not exactly the best. They're not the best, but they're not.
They're not the best, but they're not the worst I've seen. There's
exactly. They are not like cold-blooded, quote-unquote, redskins. But there is a scene where you're watching the villain pick them off on the side of the road like roadkill. Oh, I'm going to shoot this guy on a horse that's done nothing, but he's just annoyed me. I mean, I know you're supposed to know he's bad, but I'm sitting there thinking like, God, we're way too cavalier about the loss of a human life in this movie.
Well, what got me was the scene Stanwyck's character is talking to one of the pioneer women, and then the whistle goes off, and Stanwyck goes, engines!
Yeah.
It's like, get everybody inside! I'm going, oh, dear.
And again, I know it's 1939. I should not be surprised by this.
My favorite saying, good old-fashioned family racism.
Yeah, I mean, it is hard to watch this in 2018. And they are very cavalier. I mean, they kill this person and they're just like, oh, we didn't need to do that. This isn't a rabbit that we just shot on the side of the road.
It's just one guy. One kid. All by himself on a horse riding with the train. I'm going, come on, guys.
And Dodge City has a very similar bent of the idyllic West. This is not anything new. This is what we were doing in the lead up to the war. Stagecoach, I think, is an interesting contrast to this. Because Stagecoach is a group of people that are all flawed in some way, having to find their own redemption in their travels to the appropriately titled Lordsburg. You have characters that are genuinely redeemed for their actions, especially Claire Trevor's character, who is a prostitute. She wants that domesticity, and she's allowed that to a point. I'm a big fan of Stagecoach, actually, so... all of those movies really work together to bring back the Western in the late 30s.
It's definitely an evolution of the Western.
Yes, and really, DeMille was coming off of a pirate film. He had made The Buccaneer. He didn't really know whether he was going to make his next movie about airplane ships or trains. So I'm assuming that he was really into modes of transportation.
Roll a dice.
Which one? Actually, he had settled on the film on the discovery of Hudson's Bay. He learned that there was another studio working on it, so he decided to drop that. And his publisher suggested a film about the building of the Transcontinental Railroad. And he didn't know whether he was going to make a movie about the Union Pacific or the Santa Fe, so he flipped a coin.
Oh, how cute. Guess what?
I'm fairly confident they made a movie about the Santa Fe Railroad.
I feel like they did. I was just thinking that to myself.
Yeah, and this movie is very pro-railroad, which makes sense because DeMille had their cooperation. They gave him access to records, to plans. They loaned him trains used in the 1860s. He had 37 cars from the period. They let him use miles of track in Utah to shoot. It's presented in a very positive light, would you say? It brings commerce, and it brings people together. If anything, the worst thing that can happen to you on a train is an avalanche or those damn dirty Redskins.
Yeah, I was about to say shot in a train robbery.
Let's talk about the two big set pieces for this movie, because they are pretty big. So there's the train crash, which I'm assuming is all miniatures.
That would be my best guess, yeah.
Somebody can tell us if that wasn't, but there's a point where Joel McRae's Jeff, and I want to say it's Molly's dad?
Mm-hmm, yes.
I think, are on the train. They've shored up the track on this precarious mountainside that's covered with snow, and it collapses, and there's this big train crash. It looks fantastic.
It did. The polish in the film with those sequences was just incredible.
It's pretty amazing to watch, and it's filmed in this Hindenburg-esque moment. It really leads up to the more brutal set piece, which is Molly and Dick get married. Molly lets him escape, and he comes back, but they're interrupted when the Indians attack. The train is derailed, and the only people that survive are Jeff, Molly, and Dick. And they're trying to telegraph Cheyenne for help with this, like, ingenious MacGyvering of rail lines.
That was great.
And it's essentially watching them fight for their lives as the troop, the cavalry, comes to the rescue. And I liked it, but I preferred when it was about the trio of them trying to survive. When it's about the cavalry sitting there looking at the little SOS thing, they're like, we're getting messages. It's probably not that important. They realize, like, maybe it's them. And you're trying to watch them scramble together to get out. It really diminishes the momentum.
And I thought that was where the movie really struggled. I liked it when it was a character piece with the three of them. I liked any of the story revolving around that. Anytime it got into the politics, when it stepped away to the cavalry, stepped away to the politicians in the suits in the offices, it felt like a complete detractor.
I do like how it's presented. I do like how it's laid out, but it comes at the 2-hour mark. You're just waiting for things to end. And of course, like any good Western of the late 30s, you have that moment where they're running out of ammunition and they're like, okay, who are we gonna kill first?
That got so dark.
Yeah, and Molly's like, you kill me first, damn it. You kill me.
She goes, just give it to me when I'm not looking.
Yeah, I'm just sitting there like, oh God, John Wayne was here and this was the Searchers. He'd definitely help you guys out because we all know how that movie went.
When she crouches to pray and McRae pulls his gun, I'm going, whoa, dude, whoa.
Yes, you're thinking this is going to be the end of The Mist in about 10 seconds. But of course, they are saved. Before we talk about the end and what happens to Robert Preston in this movie, I want to talk about 1939 specifically. Often considered the best year of films, the 1940 Academy Awards, because we do ours the next year, had to have been a big to-do. Oddly enough, this was only nominated in one category. This was nominated for Best Effects, for the photography and the sound, even though Cecil B. DeMille won the Palme d'Or that year at Cannes. So this was not an awards contender. Are you surprised? I'm not.
Not particularly, no, considering everything else that came out. I mean, I'm looking at a very quick list of top grossing films for the year. We've got Gone with the Wind, Jesse James, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, The Rains Came, and Babes in Arms in the top five.
And really, watching this movie, I was like, these actors are all good, but they're not Oscar good.
No.
They all did better things. They all did better things. And really looking at who was nominated in some of the acting categories for that year, again, this is considered the best year in cinema. I couldn't make an argument for Joel McRae besting anybody else. Or no. Robert Preston.
Definitely not. And Stanwyck had done so much
better.
Right,
exactly. Yeah, there's really no reason for any additional awards. What I am surprised by, though, considering this was DeMille, is that this was not nominated for picture. Was that surprising for you?
Potentially a nomination.
Union Pacific was not nominated at all for Best Picture. It was Gone with the Wind, Dark Victory, Goodbye Mr. Chips, Love Affair, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Ninotchka, Of Mice and Men, Stagecoach, Wizard of Oz, and Wuthering Heights. Damn, that's a lineup.
That's hard competition there. I don't know who you take out.
Having not seen a couple of these, maybe Of Mice and Men?
I've seen Of Mice and Men. I enjoyed that. I haven't seen Ninotchka.
Oh, see, I would... Ninotchka, I think, is good. I think it gets in more for Garbo talking.
Yeah.
It's entertaining. I haven't seen Goodbye, Mr. Chips either, but I mean, Donat is beloved for that movie.
I was about to say, that movie's beloved.
Yeah, so I can't really complain. Everything else I could not argue does not belong here. You also had a Sherlock Holmes movie out that year. You had...
Even just between as the two westerns, because Stagecoach pops up there a lot. I thought... Stagecoach was a better film. I would agree
a better film. Some other movies that were out in 1939, just to show you how hard the bar was for Union Pacific. You also had Young Mr. Lincoln, Only Angels Have Wings, The Women, Gunga Din, Hunchback of Notre Dame, Four Feathers, Roaring Twenties, Babes in Arms, Bachelor Mother, The Little Princess, Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, Dodge City. I mean, it was a great, great year. I almost contemplated doing a whole year of just 1939 movies because everything just sounds so great. Many people would not consider this DeMille's best. I did want to bring up some alternative casting really briefly. We grouse about Barbara Stanwyck. She was not the first choice. She was not the second choice either.
Really?
Cecil wanted Jean Arthur, who had starred in The Plainsman. The studio also brought up Irene Dunne. I could see Jean Arthur. Jean Arthur definitely felt comfortable in the West.
I could see either of those
I don't think either one of these two ladies could have done an Irish accent.
I feel like Irene Dunne could have potentially, from what I've seen of her, she could have been an interesting choice in that.
And Frederick March was also considered for the role of Dick Allen.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah. Can you imagine McRae, Irene Dunne, and Frederick March in this movie?
That's a fascinating image,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that is definitely intriguing.
That could have been potentially a better
movie.
It
could have been. This had a huge buildup. This had a huge publicity machine associated with it. They took the stars to Nebraska for 3 days to have this big premiere. President Roosevelt was at the premiere screening. He pushed a button at the White House and supposedly had set up this big thing. They did a whole 15-day press tour with the train. It was a top-grossing Western of the year, made a profit on a cost of $1 million, which was not something that people did at the time.
That was a million-dollar movie.
Yeah, it has been honored a lot by other people, especially in the 70s. In 75, it was honored with a Western Heritage Award, but I don't think this movie is remembered in comparison to other 1939 films.
No, definitely not. There's the problem right there is 1939, you got hit with so much so fast. There's so many other movies in there that it's incredibly stiff
competition. Right, and I think when you're also comparing it to something like Stagecoach, which is already so good and it's so nuanced and it's just so filled with characterization that DeMille opened the door for the Western, and I think it shot him in the foot a little bit because this is good, but other movies did it better. I do want to end us with talking about Robert Preston's death in this movie. The film ends with everybody in Ogden. The bad guys are thwarted. The golden spike is driven in. It's Brian Donlevy's character, Campo, who is vowing to kill Jeff. He's vowing to kill him. Dick has already told Molly that he's going to turn himself in so that he can be worthy of her. And he's walking down the street, and Campo thinks that Dick is Jeff and shoots him. You have this relationship between Dick and Jeff that has been very homoerotic, very romantical. And in fact, their union, their similarities to each other, mm-hmm. is what gets Dick killed. I'm not saying that Cecil is advocating against same-sex mm-hmm. relationships, but he is making an argument in 1939. Please don't send me bad emails. I found it funny. I will let you know that ending is recreated in other Robert Preston movies. This is not the first time
he's really?
Killed in a case of mistaken identity. I want to say it's either, it might be Northwest Mounted Police, where he also...
Another DeMille,
where he ends up dying in a case of mistaken identity.
What cracks me up thinking of it in that respect, a few scenes before, there's a scene where McRae's character and Preston's character are saying goodbye, you know, right before McRae and Stanwyck's character go off together. And they're standing next to each other, and McRae must have been 8 inches to a foot taller
yeah,
than Preston.
Yeah, I mean, Brian Donlevy kind of screwed up, because there's really no way he should have confused the two of them.
Ultimately, Preston's character just said the only way you can redeem him is in death.
Right, and that's the constant in his career, is what I'm seeing, is that most of his characters, 9 times out of 10, he is the Sean Bean of film, because he dies in everything. Mm-hmm. And most of it's either mistaken identity. The point is that he's always dying to avenge his reputation, to prove that he's a good man. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you have all this build up to Molly being, if this guy wasn't around, we'd be together, and it's inconvenient that we just off him in the last, like, 2 minutes.
It's the pace, that was such a just tacked on the way it is. I was surprised, because watching it through, I'm going... It felt like to me there was a lot of, okay, it could end here. Oh no, okay, it's still going. Okay, it could end here. And to go through all of the, and all these sequences kind of after the initial character stuff on the train wraps up, to have Preston's character die in the last 2 minutes of the
right,
film.
And ultimately, the movie doesn't really situate himself as the villain. That's the confusing thing, is that he's not necessarily a bad person. He's killed because you can't have Stanwyck go off with this guy that she doesn't really love. You need to have the lovers reunited at the end. He dies purely for convenience.
Well, she's married to
right.
him. So there's no way she can right. go off with McRae while her
and
husband is still
alive. And also because we have to be told, you know, he's not perfect. And we can't keep the bad guys alive. We have to off him. And that would continue. And watching some of his later films, I mean, Bojest, he's not in it very much, so his character's just kind of the third guy. Northwest Mounted Police, his characters always tended to fall in love. If they weren't falling in love with a girl that obviously loved somebody else, it was the wrong type of woman. So Northwest Mounted Police, he's in love with Paulette Goddard, who is quote-unquote savage, and she's crazy. You know, something like Parachute Battalion, which is not a great movie. He's a cocky ladies' man. You know, that was the other thing he played. He always had to be characters that were presented in the context of romance. His plot is really incidental to the movie. He's just the wrong guy. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
And he made his career off of being the wrong guy. And for some people, that works.
I mean, and that's probably what he ultimately wanted to get away from. Because, I mean, you see him do this stretch of movies really for the first half of his career and then completely changes things.
I don't think Union Pacific, it started his career, but I don't think it's representative of his best work at all.
It's definitely representative of his early career.
Yes. But overall, what did you think about Union Pacific, Preston included?
Sitting where it was, I enjoyed it. There were good parts, there were bad parts. I have my nitpicky complaints, but I mean, as an early Robert Preston film, I enjoyed it. In terms of Westerns, like I already said, I enjoyed Stagecoach better. But I mean, it's a solid kind of middle-of-the-road film in a very tough cinematic year.
Yeah, I would agree. This movie had a lot of obstacles going for it. Coming out in 1939, being a DeMille epic, having the cast that it has... You could expect better, but when better is already so high. This is great. I enjoyed watching this. I thought it was going to be a slog. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed seeing Joel McRae. Barbara Stanwyck's good. Robert Preston's really good. I think he's almost too good. I don't think we give him enough credit in this movie.
No, and that's kind of where I thought he was so charismatic and so interesting and so entertaining. I felt he was really the high point for me.
He's definitely good at being the romantic guy. And what I really appreciate about his acting in general and his characters is that he's not, talk about Hollywood, they had faces then. Robert Preston was a good-looking guy, but he wasn't overly glamorous. He was attainable.
Coming at a time where your competition is Cary Grant, yeah, where your Clark competition Gable. Is Clark Gable, there's a hell of a lot to live
yeah,
up to.
Yeah, and I think that worked for him. I think that also hobbled him a little bit, because it left him to play these second banana type of characters.
Definitely.
He's America's, like, perpetual ex-boyfriend. You're like, he's great. He's a really great guy, but he yeah, wasn't for
yes.
me. Those are the characters he plays.
Joel McRae was just better.
Yeah, exactly. He's the guy you date before you find the guy you marry. That sounds horrid.
I love it.
But you can send me your thoughts on Robert Preston, about Union Pacific, Cecil B., whatever you want to talk about. You can email your thoughts to me at ticklishbiz@gmail.com, and I'll read them on the next episode. I would like to thank Kimberly Pierce for joining me today.
Thank you.
Kim, where can fans find and get in touch with you?
I am probably most often on Twitter at kpierce624. Most of my writing life is spent over at Geek Girl Authority doing movie reviews and stuff from there. Check us out. And my, as always, Weekly with Citizen Dame.
Yes, which you can find at Citizen Dame Pod on Twitter or citizendame.podbean.com. But Kim will be back, because we will be discussing The Music Man in the next episode. So hopefully Robert Preston will have graduated to husband. I don't know. That'll close out this edition of Ticklish Business. You can listen to Ticklish Business a variety of ways, either directly at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, via Stitcher Radio and Player FM, or on iTunes. If you are listening via iTunes, please consider helping the podcast out by leaving a rating. As always, you can contact me directly at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, at gmail.com, or visit me at my official website, where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysinclassicfilm.com. The podcast is also on Twitter at ticklish_biz. Want to learn more about upcoming episodes or hear exclusive content before anyone else? Then consider supporting Ticklish Business via Patreon. I have a wealth of amazing perks, and all of your donations go right back into making Ticklish Business the premier classic film podcast it is. Also, anyone who becomes a patron in the month of March is eligible for a secret prize pack from the Ticklish Biz Vault. If you're interested in learning more, head over to patreon.com/ticklishbiz. Want to learn more about the stars turning 100 this year? If you're a member of TCM's exclusive fan club TCM Backlot, then you can read my year-long centennial celebration series about the stars highlighted on the podcast. I talk films and information that you won't hear on the show. Next time, March comes to a close as Kimberly Pierce and I travel down to River City to talk about the Robert Preston musical, 1962's The Music Man. Till next time.